She's widely praised for devoting her professional life to serving her country, South Africa. Naledi Pandor has held several positions in the government under different presidents. Minister of Education, Minister of Science and Technology, Minister of Home Affairs, and Minister of Higher Education too. And in May 2019, President Cyril Ramaphosa appointed Pandor Minister of International Relations. As South Africa's top diplomat, she faces many challenges. From a country paying for some of the consequences of the US-China trade war, to the diplomatic struggles brought about by the unequal global rollout of COVID-19 vaccines. As world leaders gathered in New York for the 76th UN General Assembly, South Africa's message was clear.
It is an indictment on humanity that more than 82% of the world's vaccine doses have been acquired by wealthy countries, while less than 1% has gone to low-income countries. Unless we address this as a matter of urgency, the pandemic will last much longer and new mutations of the virus will emerge and spread.
And that's where we caught up with South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation. Naledi Pandor talks to Al Jazeera.
Naledi Pandor, Foreign Minister of South Africa, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera. Let's begin with the global fight against the pandemic. The figures are staggering. 6 billion people vaccinated throughout the world. Less than 2% have been vaccinated in Africa. Now, this is a vaccine disparity that the Secretary General has described as obscene. What can be done about it?
It certainly is. It certainly doesn't reflect the promise that global leaders had made at the beginning of the pandemic, that once there's a vaccine, it should be a public good. It's certainly not been treated in that way. It's clear from evidence today that a number of wealthy countries pre-booked doses of the vaccine, and in fact, many have a surplus, which they should be providing to the poorest countries in the world to ensure that all of us are vaccinated at the same time or soon after each other, because that's the only way we're going to begin to have a strong protection against this pandemic. If we leave a large number of poor people unvaccinated, we're just going to develop more variants. We're going to be a threat to each other. Because we trade, you know, we are a global community. So I think world leaders really need to wake up. It's the most powerful nations that have the surplus, and they have to be ready to support the rest of the world to vaccinate. This is the only solution to this problem.
I mean, the world leaders set themselves a target of 70% vaccinations by next year. We're in September, and this figure's not even 10% yet.
It's not been reached at all. There are countries on the continent that have hardly begun their vaccination programs. South Africa is a little way ahead because we had prepared early on. But we've also shared what we have with the continent. But we're not a wealthy country. Of course, in comparison to parts of the continent, we're better off. But we're not wealthy by any means. Countries that are talking of a booster shot are the ones that should be hanging their heads in shame because they really should be ensuring that at least the majority of the African population have one dose provided.
I mean, there's other forms of apparent inequality. For example, the UK has still got South Africa on its red list, despite the fact that South Africa is doing a lot better than a number of countries that have been removed from that red list. How do you account for this type of disparity?
It's an absolute puzzle to me. I've been speaking to colleagues from the UK. We've approached the High Commission in Pretoria, and we're not really getting clear answers. One of the insights I got this week was when one of the officials at the embassy indicated that they've been getting information from some scientists in South Africa, not from the Ministerial Advisory Committee, which has the top South African scientists, but some scientists who disagree with data that our government has been publishing. I found this absolutely astounding. The UK is a very good friend and partner to South Africa, but I'm really shocked at this red list, red listing of South Africa. I'm also horrified to learn that travel agents have been told that even South Africans who are vaccinated, as long as South Africa is on the red list, they won't be regarded as having an authentic vaccine. This is, it's madness, actually, and doesn't go well with who we know the UK to be.
It also has dire economic consequences.
For both countries, we have great interest in tourism in the UK from South Africans. We also have a lot of UK tourists who come to our country. Both countries' leisure industry has been hit very hard by the pandemic, and you would think both of us would do all that we can to revive this sector because it is such a lucrative generator of jobs and public revenue. So I've been really astounded, and I find the position adopted by the government of the United Kingdom inexplicable, to be quite honest.
In his speech to the UN General Assembly, President Ramaphosa identified three countries of concern. He made the plea for Western Sahara, for people to have the right of self-determination, for the Palestinians to get their own state, and for the embargo against Cuba to be dropped. Would it be correct to say that these are the country's international priorities in terms of its international diplomacy?
Well, there's certainly a concern for South Africa in terms of access to human rights and self-determination, which, as you know, was a long struggle for South Africans. The people of Sahrawi were a good friend to us in the course of struggle. The people of Palestine similarly, and of course Cubans even sacrificed their lives on our soil in Southern Africa. So we are concerned at the denial of opportunity for those three countries.
You mentioned there that these countries supported South Africa in its struggle to obtain human rights. We have that being solidified in the Durban Declaration, 20th anniversary of the Durban Declaration, and yet you still have a number of countries, including the U.S., including Israel, boycotting this conference. This would appear to cut against the promise to abolish racism, would it not?
Well, it's really, really disappointing that several countries decided to boycott our roundtable and did not participate in discussions on the resolution that was unanimously adopted. I've been looking at the list of countries that over time have boycotted various events associated with the struggle against racism. The number has grown from about, I think, 9 countries to 21 now. So it's clear that there's someone doing work mobilizing against the Durban Declaration and its positive intentions, which are action by the world to combat racism and all forms of intolerance. So I cannot understand why such an objective would be regarded as antithetical to rather more developed countries, several of which were the cause of the very racism we're all trying to combat today.
We're looking at double standards, are we not?
I think so. I think lack of will, lack of courage. We've seen with Black Lives Matter and the lack of responsiveness to addressing racial inequality in the United States and inadequate response to ensuring that the conduct of the security services is improved vastly with respect for human rights and individuals. So I think what you're seeing is an inability of some governments to directly confront these difficult questions. You know, racism is not an easy prejudice to combat, but it's something that a democratic government should never rest at addressing.
I mean, what many observers find astounding is that recent events in the United States, for example, you mentioned the Black Lives Matter movement, its rise, the nationwide protests that one saw because of police violence against African Americans, and yet the U.S. still boycotts an anti-racism conference. There appears to be no rationale in a way.
Maybe it's an intention to say we don't think we have a problem. I mean, we can all see it, but perhaps if you ignore it, you pretend that it goes away. But it rears its head and will continue to do so. We're trying in South Africa. I mean, we're not innocent by any means and have our own problems of racism and all forms of discrimination, including violence against fellow Africans. But these are matters that we are confronting directly and talking to our population about, you know, inculcating in them a sense of social cohesion and an understanding of the responsibility we have as a constitutional state with a Bill of Rights to protect others and not to regard those who come from another country as being different from South Africans. So you either have a government that is bold and that will confront these issues, as President Ramaphosa does, or you have governments that shy away, maybe because the problem is too awful for them to believe they can grapple with it.
You mentioned that South Africa is dealing with its own issues as well. We saw the fault lines expressed following the arrest of former President Zuma, where you had his supporters clashing with others. In July, you had, you know, unrest through many parts of the country. How is it possible to eradicate these fault lines that still appear to remain between people?
I'm not surprised that South Africa would have such problems. It only has 25 years of democratic practice, so it's very new to democracy. And that which we're trying to build is something that not everybody is familiar with or would support. President Ramaphosa has been, I think, very courageous in confronting corruption in South Africa, particularly in the public sphere, and in putting in place structures that would assist in revealing the extent of corruption and the abuse of public institutions. You don't set about that with people just happily saying, okay, go on. And I think there's a lot of opposition to what he's trying to do. And my view is that those who were encouraging this insurrection attempt that we saw in July are people who are actually against us fighting corruption and ending it in South Africa.
Are you seeing some kind of deep state movement that's in place?
I think there are people. There's evidence that there was a lot of use of social media, that very poor people were encouraged to go onto the streets and to loot businesses. Businesses were spoken of as racial institutions, you know, white monopoly capital is the phrase they use. And, you know, this sense of you are wronged by these businesses, go out and destroy them and you'll be rich and have a job. And of course, over 50,000 people lost their jobs as a result of this looting and rioting. So clearly people were lied to. And I think as they reflect on what happened in July and what they did, they realize that someone has actually tricked them.
Now, to what extent as well, and this is a delicate question given South Africa's past in terms of ethnic rivalries, is that what we appear to see in July as well was almost a rerun of the Zulu nationalism that preceded the 94 elections. Is this an ongoing issue, or is it a coincidence?
I think that, you know, there's a fragility around ethnicity, given our history. And, you know, ethnicity and ethnic identity were abused. And there's been, in the past 10 years, some marshalling of ethnic nationalism. You know, you had T-shirts, I'm 100% Zulu, and stuff like that. Which we, you know, had to discourage. So there is that. But I don't think it's a phenomenon of the entire South Africa. I mean, it's important to recollect that this looting we saw was in two provinces out of nine. So it wasn't the whole of South Africa in flames. And, you know, thank God for that. And what was really great to see was the South African ordinary public standing up and saying, not in our name.
You mentioned there about the fight against corruption. It was one of President Ramaphosa's campaign promises to eradicate corruption. Yet he has his critics who still say that he's not doing enough. How do you counter that type of criticism?
Well, investigations are underway. People are being arrested. They're being tried by our courts. That's a judicial function. And the commission of the Zondo Commission, as it's called, on state capture, its work is underway, and I'm sure we'll have a report by the beginning of next year, and more prosecutions will follow. So it's through serious attention to all the wrongs that were done that you wage this particular battle. But corrupt people don't reveal themselves, you know, in the daylight and say, hey, look at me, I'm corrupt. So you also have to ensure that you build appropriate capacity in your crime intelligence and your intelligence and security services so that you have the ability to catch these people out. We also would be helped, of course, by the international community. As you know, with some of the corruption that we had, a number of multinational corporations that are, you know, have headquarters in the north were party to some of these corrupt practices. And we find this not just in South Africa, but in other parts of the world. So I think we have to begin to hold up aspects of the private sector to account as well.
I think that's a very important issue. The investigations that we've heard with regard to former President Zuma, for example, do indicate that involvement of these multinational corporations in terms of inflicting a form of corruption within a society.
Yeah, well, of being party to it, encouraging it, payment of bribes for significant contracts, or getting very large contracts and then executing a very poor job. There's money that we're now getting back through the courts for poor services provided to various state-owned companies. We're beginning to claw back, and we're determined that we will.
Do you think it's possible to rebuild the trust of the public that was so shattered during the years of President Zuma?
Well, I think if you're transparent, if you're accountable and you take action, you will rebuild trust. But I do get a sense that the public is fed up, so it's going to be, you know, a long, hard job to persuade people. But I believe through practical example, they will come to realize that government is serious and intent on repairing this.
You mentioned as well the problems that South Africa still faces, 25 years into democracy, massive unemployment, all of these issues still trying to get health to all the population. It seems that there remain a myriad of issues despite more a quarter century of democracy.
Well, we're talking racism in the United States of America after over 200 years. South Africa is just 25, and you had the worst form of racial social engineering that you've seen in any part of the world. Apartheid was mastery of social engineering of the worst kind. So it will take time. We won political freedom. We didn't win economic freedom. We don't have control of the you know, large levers of the economy. We have to grow the economy, and I believe we've got to invest much more in sectors that will make a difference to GDP growth in South Africa.
Just on a broader kind of diplomatic front, we've seen recently the formation of alliances which have pushed away others, it would be argued, such as the UK, US, Australia deal at the expense of France. South Africa is a part of BRIC, a massive alliance, very important. But all these different alliances, do they create a problem on the global stage in terms of creating a unilateral rather than multilateral basis, as the U.S. has been accused of in recent weeks?
I think if they work toward a development agenda, then they exist for the good. But if they work in a manner that seeks to compete with each other and destroy one economy and have another being, you know, the largest in the world and everybody else, you know, should disappear, then you have problems. The biggest task I think the global community has before it is to encourage China and the United States of America to find each other. Because if they don't, if they have a trade war, it affects all of us. So it is, I think, very, very important that those leaders sit down around a table, work out what the issues of concern are and what the likely remedies might be. Because them sorting out their problems is absolutely imperative to our economic success. So that level of conflict worries us at that point because it impacts on everybody. I don't think the associations are a difficulty. It depends on what they do. I certainly, if I had a contract with you and you went and contracted with someone else without even telling me you're not happy with my, I wouldn't regard you as a good friend. You'd have to really explain to me why you did that. So I think that was most unfortunate. I don't think it was well handled. The UK, USA and Australia have to look at how they repair relations with Europe, because I think Europe, apart from France, was quite offended. And it was really the manner of doing rather than the actual action itself. So I do think, for me, yes, there are all these associations, but there are points at which we do come together. You have G20, where we have a very strong development focus, and then there's G7, where we're a guest, and there may be a more limited set of issues that we look at, primarily finance and economy, but G20, there's a far broader agenda. Then you have BRICS, where again we're looking within the five nations, how we work together to advance our development priorities. And even the building of the new development bank of BRICS has been a very positive step, because in the midst of the pandemic, we were able to secure some loans from the BRICS bank that assisted us in managing some of the fallout that occurred as a consequence of the hard shutdown we had to implement.
Acknowledging that we are on the fringes of the UN General Assembly, an issue that South Africa has been pushing for years, United Nations reform. You have a scenario, for example, where the Security Council has fired permanent members, giving them a greater power than other members of the United Nations. Is this a problem and is it soluble?
It's definitely a problem. I mean, how do you have a membership organization of over 100 members and five have a huge veto and immense power? It's a clear invitation to transformation and democratization. And I think this should be addressed. This is what South Africa and the African continent have been arguing for some years. We're not saying we have the solution, but we are saying the current format is undemocratic.
Yet the solution to this lack of balance within the United Nations, once again, would appear to lie with those who are profiting most from it. It's very difficult for other countries like South Africa to be able to introduce the type of reform that would transform the United Nations into a more democratic body than it is at present.
Well, one of the lessons I learned from the struggle in South Africa was that those who believe they are least powerful can in fact be very powerful if their numbers come together with a clear goal. So I think the broader membership of the United Nations needs to embrace the notion that we need to transform and democratize. Should they do so as a membership, I don't think a few countries can stand against them, no matter how powerful they are. But there has to be a popular voice that clearly articulates the need for change and consistently works at ensuring concretely there is negotiation that spells out the character of the change. But if a few of us are just calling from the sidelines, we'll always be this way.
South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you very much.